Okay, and welcome back. Glad you're along tonight. We have 2 hours upcoming with one of the most fascinating individuals I've ever had the honor of having on the program. He is a citizen scientist. I don't know how else to frame it. He is a true hero to many. His research into chemtrails has, aerosols, which he prefers, and it's more accurate, of course, has led the world out of the dark into the light on this issue. He's a remarkable man. His name is Clifford Carnicum. He is back with us tonight to talk about the latest research he has been doing into something which may or may not be tied to Morgellons disease. We don't know. Morgellons syndrome, Morgellons condition, Morgellons affliction, whatever you want to call it. His work is very, very frightening, I guess, in its totality. There is much to talk about with Clifford, so let's just get right to it, and welcome back my friend Clifford Carnicum.
Good evening, Jeff, and thanks a lot again. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be here again with you.
Well, it's always my pleasure. I learned so much, and so many people write in afterward saying, this guy's amazing, can it all be true? And the bottom line is, yes, it can all be true, and in all likelihood, it is. So let's step right on into this, and let's also tell people you are not operating under a grant from the Ford Foundation, for goodness sakes, or any other foundation. Your efforts come from your heart and your commitment to serving your fellow man and woman, and from people, the few out there, who are able to help by way of contributions, which is now easier because there has been a formalization of your work through the... Well, tell us about the Institute.
Well, that is a recent development, Jeff, and it is probably where my energy and effort has been put primarily over this last 8 months to a year. And that is, I've had to deal with the reality of the time and effort that I now have available. You know, life changes, economic situations change. People are under a lot of pressure these days just for their basic general survival in a lot of ways. So as I look at my time in my life and how it's changed, I realize I'm really up to a limit in terms of what I can do on a realistic level. You know, for the past year or so of my life, I'm lucky if I have a couple of hours a week that I can engage in, you know, actual research.
Sure.
And that wasn't the case. There was a time in the beginning where I would probably put in several hours a day able to work on this.
Well, back when you were originally probing the aerosol crimes and cover-up story, which you have been, I guess, doing for 10 years now, although not as intensely as you were, I remember all this very well. You've been on the program all the way through, and we've watched it and just been awed by the work you have been able to do and the time you've been able to commit to it. It's so well done.
Well, I appreciate it, and, you know, I had to make a decision as to how could I best put my time forward toward the future, and with some a little bit of prompting from some fellow associates that have been involved in this issue for several years also, and in the back of my mind, I think the timing and circumstances were right, where I decided that setting up some type of organization, basically that would carry beyond me, is mm-hmm. what it's about. We don't know how long this is going to affect humanity. A lot of times things happen a lot longer than we might think. We've already got 11 years, right, in this?
That's right.
And so looking ahead, I felt that the best way that I could establish a platform for the future, as well as under my limitations, was to establish a nonprofit organization. And that has been done with four other members on the board. There's four of us on the board and another person in the research category. Mm-hmm. And it's taken some time to do that, but it does exist now. And we're in the process of, let's say, setting priorities very quickly as to what we can do. And the mission statement of the Institute, which is under the name of Carnicum Institute and under a website by that name also, Carnicum Institute.
What a beautiful home page, if I might say. Your entry to the site is extraordinary.
We get to thank Lori Kramer for much of that work, actually. She's one
the
of
kid
them.
Did that?
Yeah, there's one four people on the board, and she's responsible primarily for the presentation to the public of.
Wow. Well, she outdid herself with this one. It's stunning.
Yeah, I've already heard many compliments on it already. And so
let me tell our listeners how to get there, Clifford. It's Carnicum
Institute.org.
There you go. C R N-I-C-O-M, carnicominstitute.org. And just take a look at that homepage. All right.
And so that stage is set, and we very quickly are establishing our priorities as to what we can do. I will say very clearly and bluntly that we will be able to accomplish little to nothing without the public involvement. That is what this is about. As I said, I have 2 hours a week, and an hour of that time is now in a board meeting, establishing our agenda and priorities. Right. How much time does that leave for me actually get work done? The best that I can offer right now to the public is primarily a sense of direction, and that's a lot of what our call will be about tonight, a sense of direction as to where I think things could go if people are sufficiently interested and involved, what could be done, and not to actually conduct the work myself. It's very unlikely that will ever happen now at this point, but to provide a platform and vehicle for the public to become involved if they wish to, and to make it very clear that nothing is going to happen, just the blunt truth, without the involvement and contributions.
Right.
You know, I'm not a promoting person, and most people, even on the board, it's going to have to be their job to help out on public relations and promotion. My work is as a researcher, but I felt strong enough about this in combination with several other people to make this available, and I'll tell you, it's very open. If you look at how this organization is structured, it invites participation at all levels without restriction or censorship. Everyone is able to offer assistance and involvement if they wish to in some way. And there is no agenda behind the scenes. And in addition, if you actually read the mission statement of this institute, it is not about the, quote, Morgellons issue. It is not about the aerosol issue singly by any fashion. It is generalized to, I would say, address the major breach of public trust that has taken place, such that any issue in the future. Again, I'm not thinking actually in terms of my lifetime, to tell you the truth, in terms of what I hope this organization to become. We have a situation where a crime and an offense of the highest nature was committed against the citizens and the planet itself. We have a case where the citizens acted appropriately to attempt to enlist the proper investigations of these crimes by the so-called authority agencies, and that process failed. Those agencies, governmental organizations, they have failed to address the needs of the public and common welfare. And I basically
failed to. I would suggest they betrayed it. They haven't just failed.
Very true. Very true. And we have to ask, what can we do in that case? And the best that I can do as an individual is to offer an avenue and a platform to basically share that responsibility for taking on the problems amongst ourselves. If these organizations and government agencies that supposedly represent us do not act in good faith, then we are called upon to act in good faith ourselves, and we have to create that platform to do that. And this
absolutely
is what I'm interested in. And so that's what the institute is about, and I would encourage people to become familiar at least with the website presentation so that you can see what we're about in principle, and then specifics depend upon you, namely the public. We will and are inviting proposals at all times from the public as to what they would like to see done. Completely open, and then we will review and evaluate those proposals and try to put the best foot forward in terms of
very good
whatever funds do become available.
Well, the work that you have done already is so inspiring to people. I hope many who care will vector their energy and contributions toward the Carnicom Institute to make sure that the work can continue, because we can't expect the government to be first honest with us and second even competent in terms of what it's supposed to be doing. We're to that stage now. It's that bad.
Absolutely right. If not us, I don't know where our hope lies. So that's there, and through the evening, you know, that might come up again where we can talk about specifics and this type of thing as to what we're involved in and trying to get involved in.
Very good.
So I thank you for that.
Sure.
And, you know, tonight I think will be a little bit different, Jeff, in a sense. I think it'll be a little bit more open. I do have some specific things I want to go over. The last time we spoke, it was very well organized. And our last show was a historical presentation of the relationship of the biological findings to the aerosol issues. And sounds like you're on a break, so when we come back, I'll briefly outline that and then go over the things that are on my mind tonight.
Very good. Okay, we'll do that in just a couple minutes with Clifford Carnicom as we continue. Okay, back to Clifford Carnicom. I'm going to talk about a number of things that he is working on, has worked on, hopes to work on, and is currently presenting on his website. And there is a lot of very concerning, perturbing, worrisome material that has popped up there. Go ahead, Clifford, please.
Oh, okay, Jeff, thanks. I think tonight will be a little bit different for us because usually I have, let's say, a fairly straightforward outline in terms of trying to have something that's very linear and logical to try and present it in that way. And our last show was very much like that. We basically had a sort of a complete chronological review
mm-hmm.
of the biological aspects
right.
of the aerosol issue.
Right.
And my point of that previous interview was to stress that the biological connection is extremely strong and that there is direct evidence, a volume of evidence, that shows a direct association between biological findings in both the environment as well as in our bodies and environmental or aerosol issues. And that is somewhat controversial because that has not been iterated to the point that I think it deserves. And so we devoted an entire show to the presentation of that case spanning basically a 10-year record, and that evidence is very strong. And but it was also very straightforward in terms of the linear nature of the discussion. And we ended with really some amazing findings involving culture work and blood. And if we
yes.
have extra
yeah.
time tonight, because I really don't have a good handle on how long this will take to get through these things on my mind, but if we have any extra time tonight, two things I could suggest. One would be to go back and review the tail end of that interview and the subject matter of that involving culture and blood work, which is absolutely astounding, I think, and also relates to what we're going to speak to tonight. And the other would be basically a deferment to you in the sense that every time I'm here, you have always given me the complete freedom to basically direct and lead all the topics, and I just wanted to say that tonight, if we have extra time, it's probably a great opportunity where you get to ask me something once in a while, and if you have any questions, it would be a great evening to bring them up where I could fill in things that I have neglected or not covered properly in the past.
Well, you've covered them all properly, believe me, but maybe we'll dredge some up and help folks who are first-timers try and at least get somewhat in the loop. Yeah, okay, great.
But that's available. But in terms of tonight, what's on my mind are three different areas, and this is not chronological or linear in its thinking. It's three different areas that I'm going to attempt to relate to one another tonight, and we'll see how we do. But here are the three issues. One of them will be a laboratory report that I encountered about a week and a half ago and had a very strong reaction to, so much so that it prompted me to contact you and form the basis for a discussion. So that's number one, awareness of a laboratory report that I simply had not seen before. The second topic would be literally just on the academic side. The subject of proteins is going to be up for tonight. And I'd like to talk about proteins and what I've been through very quickly over the last
sure.
couple of weeks with respect to proteins.
Right.
And then the third will be an attempt to relate these two issues together through some of the research that I have done over the past and to show how these two topics appear to be related in a very strong fashion. So these are the three topics: a lab report, some academic information involving proteins, and then a tie-in with research between both the academic as well as this lab report and my research or other research over several years. So that's what I'm attempting to do, and the question will be what sequence I want to go through on this. And I think what I'll do is follow it in the way that it occurred to me, what happened and what the mental process was.
Good.
And,
yeah,
and what happened was about literally a week and a half ago, this is very, very recent, but a member of the board, his name's Larry Meyer, he's actually a research associate on the Institute.
Mm-hmm.
He sends me an email, and it's only about a paragraph long at most, and I read this email, and immediately in my mind I'm saying, what the heck is this? Where did this come from? Because it's just this excerpt. And when I read this email, it starts talking about things that have been, let's say, underlying my research for 10 years, but I had never seen this in print anywhere at all at this level. And basically, it's going to involve proteins. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. And I'm extremely curious as to where does this come from. And so it's very curious to begin with. I still do not know why Larry actually picked this particular, literally, section out of this paper to send to me, because there is no foreknowledge. To my knowledge, there's not even anyone that knows the depth of the relationship of this paper to my work. So for whatever reason, I don't know, but I have to grant him a lot of credit, whether it's on an instinctive level or not.
Mm-hmm.
But he sent me this. And what happened was he sent me this paper, and even tracing down exactly where it came from was a little tricky, but this ends up, it looks like, being a paper from the University of Arizona. Now, the specific name that I have on this, I'll give the reference, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, we have to take a break, so go ahead and give the name, and we'll take a break.
Yeah, the name is Robert Smith, and he's a person who has a bachelor's in genetics, and apparently his master's in genetics, too, or chemistry. I can't tell which.
Huh.
And it involves a paper that was written on July 28th of 2006.
Hmm.
And this paper is available so far on two websites, the Charles Holman Foundation website and also the Morgellons Research Foundation website.
Okay.
This is where the paper exists. And then I guess when we come back, I'll go over what this paper said.
Very good.
And we'll go from there.
Intriguing, as always, with Clifford Carnicum. Stand by, and we'll continue. Okay, and we return, continuing with Clifford Carnicum tonight. Clifford, please go ahead and tell us more about this very unusual paper.
Thank you very much, Jeff. So what happens here is you have what appears in all respects to be a very proper lab study done of fiber samples from individuals. And the work is done properly. Best I can tell, it's certainly has a detail of the disciplines of analysis that only a person well accomplished in the field would have. Now, this person, again, it's a Robert Smith, a bachelor's and a master's in genetics and or chemistry. So everything is on the level in terms of this paper, in terms of how it's presented and the way it's written up. So when I read this, the heart of this is that this person analyzes this fiber through proper detailed methods. There's like five methods that I've come up with by which a person can do this kind of work. I see two of them referenced in this particular paper. But the guy does a study of a fiber, and here's what he finds. He finds three things in this fiber. The first is what's called keratin.
Mm-hmm.
Keratin is a protein.
Again, to recap, Clifford, excuse me, where did the fiber come from exactly?
Well, I can, you know, what's interesting about this paper, the paper has no title at the top of it.
Hmm.
What the specific paragraph that interests me a great deal is paragraph B of this thing. And remember, uh-huh. This is on the Charles Holman Foundation.
Right.
It's called Lab Work on Fiber, July 28, 2006. And it's also, I believe it's on the Morgellons Research Foundation, but I'm not positive of that. I know it's on this Charles Holman Foundation. But the specific paragraph of the paper that intrigues me is entitled Fiber Protein Composition, Section B. And his statement is fibers from a patient with Morgellons syndrome. This is what I know about the source.
Very interesting.
I don't know the individual name.
So,
you know, there's two papers, but I'm going to focus on by two different parties that have caught my interest. But I'm really going to focus on this one because this laboratory report, it's very specific. This is not something in general language. These are proper laboratory procedures with spectral analysis and this type of thing.
Okay,
exactly the type of thing we've all been clamoring for years on.
I'm hearing that, yeah.
And here we have this paper, and I'm seeing, and it amazes me, but the truth is I am completely unaware of the old famous statement of the EPA, but I am totally unaware of this paper. I've never seen this before.
No, this is amazing. I can't wait to hear more.
Yeah,
please.
So I'm astounded when I start seeing this because if you read what the guy says he found, he finds three things. He finds the spectral work as well. He finds a band corresponding to keratin, and it's basically every protein. One of the things we'll learn tonight is that every protein has a specific mass, a specific molecular mass, and this is your unique way of identifying a protein. So he has three of them. He finds keratin. He finds serum albumin, okay? Now, again, what happens is I start thinking about this when I see this, but he finds keratin, serum albumin, and then he has a third one, which he calls a fluorescent protein, and what he's saying is this guy is unknown. We cannot identify this third protein, and it is of a fluorescent nature, which is very interesting because fluorescent proteins are a category or a class which have great value in terms of their use for tracking ability. You see, if you can see something under a fluorescent light, it's extremely valuable for its ease of tracking. Okay, they occur in nature in a very interesting class of proteins, what they call fluorescent proteins. So this is what the guy finds, these three things: one keratin, one serum albumin, and one completely unknown, and he says, I cannot find it. Not only that, not only can he not identify it, but he specifically says this third protein, this fluorescent protein, is of no known human origin of any kind. He cannot attach it to the human species in any way.
Not surprised, but surprised to see it in the paper. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And what happened was I saw this, and it's probably acting at a subconscious level, but I really have this double take on this single paragraph that Larry said.
Oh, I would too, sure.
Because I'm starting to make connections in my mind, and I say, first of all, a keratin. Why is keratin important to me? I've done some work with keratin in the past. It's caught my interest. Mm-hmm. Hardly anybody really knows about that work, but I know it's important to me, and I'll go over that. And then I take serum albumin, and I say, well, what is this? And what do I find? Serum albumin is the most common protein, the dominant protein in blood plasma.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is what it is.
Right.
Remember, we're talking about a fiber sample. Okay, presumably at the skin level, from an individual that we're speaking of here, and we're talking about finding a protein that its characteristic is that it's a part of blood. It's not a part of a skin or a hair or a fiber.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one is this complete unknown that has no tie-in human origin known. And so this is when I start to go to work. And what happens is I start digging out the books. And the other reaction is I know I'm interested in keratin, and then learning that serum albumin has to do primarily with blood, there's already connections going on with my work, some of which is known, some of which is not entirely known. But the process that happens then is I start saying, Clifford, what do you know about proteins? And what I realize is I know very little, okay? To be honest, proteins, I mean, what did I know? My reaction on proteins, I say, oh, proteins, you know, they're necessary for diet, you know, 15% of the diet. I know they're important building blocks of nature, this type of thing. But my knowledge is fairly general, you know, and it doesn't have a great deal of depth to it. But immediately, I am drawn to dig into this issue of proteins and to understand why might proteins be significant. Why would this individual be finding three proteins within this sample? And what is the real meaning and impact of that finding? And so I dig into the books, and one of the next topics, if we're willing to tonight, it's more on the academic side, but it's basically I spent probably close to a week and a half just digging through every textbook I could to basically educate myself as quickly as possible about the nature of proteins And what do they? What are really the implications of proteins? And it's absolutely amazing to me. I mean, I'm just plain dumbfounded on it. And what I've tried to do tonight is distill that process of me going through my education to about maybe a dozen statements that encapsulate what I've learned and why I believe this is so very relevant and important to the topic that we're speaking of tonight in respect to this lab report. And when we have time, you're willing, I'll go through these sort of one at a time.
Yeah. We have to take a break here in just about a minute. But this is fascinating. Anything else noted in that paper about the contents or the formation of those fibers, what made them?
No, the paper, this particular paper, you know, what he does is compare it to a regular hair for control.
Okay.
And then he looks at this paper. It's fairly short. The paper's fairly short.
Mm-hmm.
And he has the paragraph on composition, which is what we're on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has a paragraph called future direction, which is going to be very important to extract a couple of sentences from later tonight
also.
Okay,
we'll do that. This is, as always with Clifford, fascinating, cutting-edge information, having to do with, in this case, a paper addressing the composition of a Morgellons fiber or fibers which were put through rigorous scientific evaluation. All right, we're all ears. Be right back. Okay. Clifford Carnicom is my guest. Fascinating already, the information we're hearing. We're talking about a paper which compares a human hair and a Morgellons fiber and what therein was discerned. Albumin deficiency, by the way, albumin, I think, synthesized only by the liver and the body, and I don't know that by eating egg whites you can raise your albumin levels, but they're critical for good health. It's a protein that's essential. It is often deficient in people, and it can lead to, apparently, some very serious issues. But that's another story. Please go ahead, Clifford. I've got the paper. I'm going to post it at Rents.com to make sure everyone can follow along here.
That's great, Jeff. Thanks a lot. And you might be able to fill in some things, too, in terms of your knowledge on the health side as we go along here tonight. And also, I'm getting the sense that this two-hour thing is not going to be a problem, that we're going to put this 2 hours to work.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty much, from what I can tell, because we have some things to cover here. Okay, so, and by the way, so this paper is done in 2006, right? And that's astounding me, too, because I'm saying...
How did it escape notice?
Yeah, no kidding. This thing's been sitting for 3 years here, and it's posted actually front and center on a site. But, hey, nobody's talking about this. What's going on? And so I think I'll jump ahead and go ahead and tell you what this lab person said about future direction, what he said about he wanted to happen in the future regarding this study, and then we'll come back to it again, I think, at the end.
Sure.
And tie it in with some of the same aspirations that I have. But this guy does this work where he finds these three things, right, which actually should be of great interest to people when we start realizing what he's saying here. And then he says, okay, what do we do now? And here's what he says. Some of it I'll paraphrase, some of it I'll read two sentences. But first thing he says is that this fluorescent protein he has a great deal of interest in because it's completely unidentified. Nobody knows what it is, and it has no human origin, right? So he says we ought to be sending this particular protein, distillation or separation, to it must be Oklahoma State University, I assume, OSU. He says we ought to send it to OSU Stillwater's proteomic facility. Now, what the heck is that? Proteomics is apparently a very important science that has developed. It has to do, just as we have sequence in genomes and such, and the whole genetic thing is understood through that sequencing, the same thing is happening with proteins. And the article I was reading is even elevating the understanding of proteins as being even more significant in many ways than the genetic research.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you're looking at methods of identifying the specific amino acids that are in that protein. He's basically saying we need to send this to a high-level laboratory that has the ability to identify the actual structure, the makeup of this protein, this unknown protein, so that we can either identify it and, or even if we can't identify it, to start determining its nature and function. Because as we learn about proteins, it just fascinates me. And we'll talk about more about them, but their structure can be important in what they do, you see, what their function is. So that's the first thing he says, is we need to send this off. and get this thing properly identified. And then he says that it has been sent to that facility. And then his last statement there is currently this protein identity is unknown. Well, this is the first thing that bothers me, okay, because I have a paper written in 2006 that says I've got an unknown protein, specifically says, hey, let's get this identified, sent off to someplace supposedly to be done. And my question is, okay, what's been done? What is it?
In three years.
What do we learn? And my point tonight is, round 378, I don't see anything being done. Maybe I'm missing something, but please let the world know what was the outcome of identifying this unknown protein. And I don't have that information yet, and if anybody has it, let's get it out front and center as soon as we can, is what it amounts to. The other statement he has, two short ones I'll read. He says the fluorescence, he's talking about this particular fluorescent protein. Mm-hmm. He says, isolated to a protein composition may be a unique feature to Morgellons patients. And he says, further protein analysis of the fluorescent factor may yield clues to the infectious agent identity, as the protein does not, in this single sample, correspond to any potential human gene or protein product.
Would you repeat that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I heard it. I want to make sure everyone out there does.
Absolutely. I'll slow it down a little bit, too. He says, further protein analysis of the fluorescent factor, he's speaking of the fluorescent protein factor, may yield clues to the infectious agent identity, as the protein does not, in this single sample, it's the only one he has, correspond to any potential human gene or protein product.
In other words, folks, it may not be of this planet. He's never seen it. This is a scientist. So far in 3 years, we've gotten nothing back officially or formally from anyone else about this that I know of either. Totally weird.
It is. And so that's his, this is a straight lab report in what the guy says. He even acknowledges, you know, at the end, my sample's extremely small, folks, you know, can't extend it beyond what I know and can't write it up to be more than it is. But he specifically tells us what he finds through proper techniques,
right,
and he tells us what he thinks should be done, okay? And to my knowledge, I don't know of it being done. I'm open to it. If somebody can tell me this has all been done, then lay it out, because I certainly want to know.
Here's what else he says.
That's largely what prompted this call tonight.
Absolutely. Here's what else he says. As of now, this is 3 years ago, the samples have been sent to Dr. Wymore due to complications with communicating with the Stillwater facility. Currently, this protein identity is unknown. Now, I want to know what's been done, just like Clifford wants to know. If these samples were sent to Randy Wymore, what was the analysis on his end? What did he find? What are his thoughts? And I'm not up to speed on this, and it's a little bit disconcerting.
And the other thing that will go along, I'm sorry, but everybody's going to have to prove themselves on their work over time. And any lab report, no matter what I see, will have to be confirmed in numerous ways to satisfy my standards in terms of level of trust in that work before it's all over with. It just because of the tricks that have been played, and that'll come up tonight also in the discussion we have. Any work, no matter what it is, even if this facility, this proteomic facility, did their work, I will need to see that work duplicated at some level to establish confidence in it because of the misgivings that have taken place along the way.
Sure.
Now, the next topic is the academic side, if people are willing to bear with me. And I hope this is not just my indulgence, but what happened was I was educating myself as a result of this paper. What are the implications of this and what does this mean? And we may have two levels. We may have, you know, people like me that really didn't have that much of a knowledge about what proteins are really about and just admit that. That was my case. And the other is, well, you know, we may have a whole herd of biochemists in there that wish that I wasn't the one talking and that they could be presenting to you what they know about proteins. I have to serve as the middleman here, and I'm going to try and, you know, distill this education process that I've been through through this last week and a half, and spell out certain key statements. It's really an extraction.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try not to. Hopefully it's not boring to me. The more I learn, the more incredible it is. And I'll take one sentence at a time, read them. And the purpose of this is to assess how might this relate our knowledge now, our increasing knowledge of proteins that we're going to gain, how might this relate to an understanding and appreciation and comprehension of what this lab report is actually telling us? Okay. That's my goal, and that was my process of education. And if you're willing, I'll go ahead with them, at least start with them, till you cut me off and I go on to the next stage. Is that okay?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. The first one was where I just learned, what do proteins do? What are they? And the first thing I found out is that proteins, they're the dominant constituent of our body. Now, I'm assuming they're removing water from that, but the most dominant compound in our body is protein. So at the very least, from the very beginning, you would be interested from a physical point of view that your existence is primarily a protein. The second thing would be the functions of proteins. What do proteins do? And there's five of these things. I won't go into detail, but these functions, realize how encompassing this issue of proteins becomes. The first one is that proteins serve as catalysts in reactions. Basically, they make reactions happen a lot faster. The second is that they transport and store compounds or molecules. The third would be that they have a structural function, like teeth and skin and bone and cellular membranes. The structural aspect is dependent upon proteins. The fourth one would be antibodies, about disease. Antibodies that attack foreign cells in our body, those antibodies are proteins. And the last one on this list would be detection of stimuli. Certain proteins have the ability to detect, basically store information. And the one example they gave there was in our retina, we have a protein that can be stimulated by light. So this is just on the function side in terms of what proteins are. Already my, awareness and appreciation of the importance of proteins increases very dramatically as I learn these things. Now, the next one is that these come out of, straight out of the textbook, in my own words, is what it amounts to. Proteins are the link between genotype and phenotype. Okay, so what does that mean? So I have to look up genotype, and then I have to learn to look up phenotype, right? Okay, genotype is our genetic constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Phenotype is our physical makeup, our physical appearance, our basically our physical presence and manifestation, our existence in the world. Proteins are the link. Now, the biochemists can get really involved in this stuff. I'm after the essence or the heart of this issue tonight. That's all I'm after. But the statement there is that the link between your genetic constitution, your memory bank of the human species and how you exist in this planet is because of proteins.
It's expressed by proteins. Sure.
Yes.
Sure,
okay?
I got it. All right. Hold on if you would, Clifford. Hold that thought, folks. We'll come right back. Another hour to go with Clifford Carnicom. This is amazing material. Any way you look at it, hopefully those of you who are interested in more gallons will pass it along as well. We'll continue right after the top of the hour break. Okay, back with you and Clifford Carnicom with us tonight. We're learning more and more all the time. Talking about a very strange and rather unknown paper written 3 years ago about a Morgellons fiber as compared to the human hair. This is fascinating, to put it mildly. Clifford, let's jump right back into it.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. And, maybe everybody else knows about this paper. It's just that I didn't, and I got to do my job because
I didn't either, my friend.
So I'm going to give a title to this section. I have the liberty of doing that, and I'm going to call the section of our discussion tonight Profound Protein School 101.
Very good.
All right? Profound Protein School 101.
That works.
We're about halfway through it. The next one. So this is school time for us, and for me too it was. The next one. DNA tells the cells what proteins to make and when to make them.
Very important. Repeat that, please.
Yeah, no kidding. All these are, if we'll take the time to really listen to them. That's why they're here. DNA tells the cells what proteins to make and when to make them.
There you go.
Now, what does this mean? Here's my interpretation at this point. First of all, now, hey, it's not just a matter of nutrition and health and the appreciation of, the importance of proteins to our body. We're already in the field of genetics in a big way. Okay, very, very quickly. when you get into proteins. Because basically, the reason that certain body proteins are in our body is through an instruction process that is an encoded genetic process, right? So if we were to say that we have some foreign protein in our body that is being synthesized, we have something being created in our body that does not normally exist in that place or operating in that function, it immediately has to call into question the consideration and role of genetic change, manipulation, or influence in that process. This is my conclusion from that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a protein appearing in your body unless it's occurring through an encoding process.
Correct.
In some form.
Someone asked it to be there.
And so if it's foreign or different in a different place, or serving a different function, or shouldn't be there, I have to ask, what is the source of this protein? Where did it come from?
Right.
And
asked?
Then as we learn about proteins, we will find that is ultimately tied to a genetic encoding process.
There you go. Yeah.
So hence the title of our subject right now. It's absolutely profound to me as I understand the implications of proteins in our body and what they mean. The next statement is, proteins determine the structure and function of the cell. So this says that what something does in our body, the particular function that it serves in our body, and even how it's made, the very form of it, and what it does in, for us in our bodies, is a result of proteins. This is why and how it happens. Next one. Oop, there goes my teapot whistling. The next one. A way of characterizing proteins is by what they attach to, the binding of molecules.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Mm-hmm. Not only do we have all these things mentioned already that we're talking about, but now there's more going on. And one way of looking at proteins and let's say classifying them as to their purpose or function is by what they attach to, what they carry. In other words, proteins have a way of attaching to things, and the things that they attach to end up becoming very important in our body. And I'll give the simplest example or one of the easiest examples to work with, and that is that hemoglobin is a protein. Okay? Hemoglobin is in our blood. What does hemoglobin do? It attaches to oxygen. Hemoglobin distributes oxygen in our body and allows us to live.
Right.
So the structure or compound or molecule that proteins attach to is incredibly important in terms of its actual function in the world. And there's no end to these things that they attach to. You know, there's another one. Oh, and they not only attach, they can also store. They can also store things. Another example was there's a protein that stores iron in our body. These are not isolated examples. The more you look into this, you'll see that basically everything under the sun revolving around transport and function, structure, and genetic encoding of our body is dependent upon proteins. Next one. I'll try to get through these this last set quicker because they'll tie in more with what's happening later. So I think I'll just read them and we'll go through them. Next one, proteins are carried in the blood plasma. Okay. Next one, albumin is the dominant protein in blood plasma. We mentioned that. And remember the lab report, okay? The lab report finds serum albumin in this filament sample. Albumin carries toxins, drugs, ions, and even in the work I was doing, I found that even prions. Prions are in part transported in the blood through albumin in the plasma. And the next one, antibodies are carried in the plasma. Next one, many medicines are proteins. And the last one, very interesting to me, proteins can be made using DNA technology. So many drugs are proteins, and these proteins or drugs can be made using DNA technology. So from my studies, I have gained a much greater realization and awareness an understanding and comprehension of the importance of proteins, basically in our very existence and life, in a way that's absolutely profound and involves essentially anything related to our being and our existence. And that was my process of discovery for this last week and a half, 2 weeks. And I hope that I've imparted, you know, again, serving as a middleman, the biochemist is obviously the person we're going to need to dig into this in detail. But I'm attempting at a layman level to stress the why this became important enough to me to contact Jeff and ask him to devote some time towards elaborating on this rather quiet report. At least appears to me it's there. But the implications in terms of what the paper is actually saying are just amazing to me, and I really appreciate you for providing this avenue for this to happen.
I mean, a fluorescent or fluorescing protein, which is unknown in the human experience, ought to be headlines in a lot of places.
I would think so. We have quite a few headlines over the years we've missed, Jeff.
Yeah.
Exactly. But at least you're helping to get the message out, and I appreciate it. And there are people, you know, there are people that pick up on it. I know that we will get a segment of the audience that understands the importance of what we're speaking about, and hopefully will act upon it also. So that's the end of the academic side. I appreciate everybody's patience to put up with that, and yet for me it was a fascinating process of discovery. I simply had no awareness at the level at which this thing is operating.
Mm-hmm.
And so we finished the school section, and now the last of the three main sections is the tie-ins between now the three things.
Right.
Right. This lab report that I am exposed to, this increased understanding and awareness of protein function, and then certain research that I and or others have done over the years that starts drawing connections that extend beyond these two things to present even a broader picture that sets the stage for work which needs to be done, which is sort of what this whole call in the end is about to me, is to try and offer some suggestions about what appears to be sensible to be done from what we know. And I don't have another 10 years to wait around. I can't wait another 3 years to discover the next paper that's important. The handwriting's all on the wall and has been for a long time now about the work that needs to be done, except now there are some very specific leads that we have to work with. And they're going to center on these topics of detailed compositional knowledge of these samples. And that process alone, to get that sampling done properly, as this one paper appears to have done. Now, in terms of how this relates to my work, it goes back really literally to the very beginning. And it's why at a subconscious level that thing was interesting me. Although I didn't have an understanding of the importance of proteins in a broad sense, I did in an underlying way have an understanding and realization that it looks like proteins are probably involved in some of these issues. And it goes way back to the very beginning, involving the infamous EPA sample that you and I have talked about.
Oh, and the infamous EPA letter, which I've had on my site and is still on yours, of course. All right, hold on. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. Just remarkable material here for you to consider. And whether or not you know anyone with Morgellons, well, you may soon. In fact, you may right now and not know it. It's, as they say, all over the place. Be right back. Okay, right back with you, and right back with Clifford. Go ahead, Clifford. This is amazing stuff. I still don't know where this paper was. Maybe someone sent it to me. It just went under my radar. It's amazing.
Yeah, my same reaction.
You going to try and contact this fellow, by the way? at some point?
I think that's inevitable at some point.
Yeah, sure.
I have to say, we all have this shared responsibility, I think, and that's partly what I'm trying to do, is extend that responsibility. We're all in this, folks, and we all have a job to do here, and you've got my 1 to 2 hours a week. You ask how much I can get done. I'm trying to make a living. We all have to help get this done, and there's a lot of questions we should all be asking, as well as pressure that we should be applying to get some answers that are very long overdue. Someone might have the impression from our discussion tonight that everything that we're talking about and my big rant on all this protein stuff might all be restricted to this single fiber in this single analysis done by this single individual, and you know, why make such a big deal out of it? Well, that's not the case. It is not restricted to that. Now I'm going to start talking about my research and how I see it as relating to the subject we're speaking of. And that is, on my side, there are, I would say, six classes of materials now. Six different physical classes of materials or samples that all of them, if you look at them in the big picture view, all of them suggest that there may be, suggest or indicate or directly show, that there is very likely a significant proteinaceous aspect about those samples. In the end, it's not a single sample we're talking about, and this is why I'm making certain connections here and why I see certain work that obviously needs to be done. And I will now take that single sample that we're talking about, the single fiber, and I will now extend that to six other classes of materials, and now I have seven for you, every one of which needs detailed, proper lab work done multiple times with controls to show the validity of the work with no tricks being played, so that we get the honest answer as to what's happening amongst all of these different sample types. And what I will do is go through those sample types with us so that you understand that this picture is a lot broader than just this single fiber by this single study. It's not what it's about. It's about a series of connections that are being made, although belatedly, that say, you know, this protein aspect, it looks like it's something we should be digging into a lot deeper. And it goes back to the very beginning with this EPA sample. And I'm not going to go through that whole story because most of us know it, because I've probably been through it a half a dozen times. So I won't go through all that. But I will jump ahead to why it's important. And that is, I mentioned last time, in fact, you know, Lee Riddle on the board, too, he also did some good work, because I knew I had said something to you, but I really didn't know, or I knew I had either written or said something, but I couldn't trace it down. And Lee found it for us, and it's on our last interview, and it was on May 8th, apparently, of 2008. He traced it down by time. It's like 62 minutes into it, about 10 minutes long.
Is that the last time you were here?
Yeah, apparently.
Gee.
It's like May 8th. But if people have an interest, go find that little section and find out what I was saying about people attempting to ridicule certain topics and my interest in proteins that I was suggesting at that time related to keratin. And also some false lab reports. That'll save a little time tonight if people were willing to go back and listen to that. I'll try to get the synopsis of it. And what happens is that EPA sample, and this is environmental, right? This is not in the body. This is an environmental sample that garnered much interest and attention because of all the unique properties of it. A whole biological thing introduced itself through those environmental samples, airborne filaments that the EPA refused to identify. Now, I mentioned it last time, but now it is more important and relevant to stress, and that is, we had a lab test done on that. By the way, another board member, how fascinating, I didn't even realize this, another board member was behind getting this test done and putting up his own money to have this testing done. This was done back in 1999, folks. It's just amazing, okay? But he had a proper lab report done on this tried to. I got to say, tried to. He paid good money, let's say. He should have had a good lab report done. We get the lab report back, and I'm told through the writing, okay, what it appears it is, but the lab report is never specific. They never tell us exactly what it is. This paper I just told you, they told me the spectral bands, they told me the molecular mass,
yep.
They told me exactly what they were doing.
Yep.
That report I got back in 1999 from this company said it may be, it looks like, it's similar to. And what did they do? They said that this particular fiber, it looks like it could be essentially spider webs. Now, if you all recall, that was the big little debunk theory that was put out there that simply
yep.
won't hold if you look into it.
Sure remember
that. All this stuff was fiber webs. But this lab report makes that suggestion.
Hmm.
As soon as they did that, I was doing my own work about, because I knew it wasn't spider webs is what it amounted to. I had 9 methods by which I could show that this was not spider webs. We went to the lab. I told you this last time in the last interview. We went to the mm-hmm. CEO of that company, confronted him directly, and I started going through my list of 9 items to tell him why I know that these are not spider webs, okay, and I'm after the true issue.
Sure.
I get through item 2. I get to item number 2 mm-hmm. on the list, and the CEO says, this meeting is over.
I remember.
Okay? And yep. people could dig into that last interview. Now, why is this important now? You got me going now, Jeff, but why is this important now? Because also, if you read that lab report, what the lab says, this environmental sample appears to be of a proteinaceous nature. And by the way, they didn't use the word appear. That's me. They said this material is of a proteinaceous nature.
Is, right?
Okay, yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. All right, hold on. We have to pause. Right there, you see what's going on, I'm sure all of you. And go back and listen. May 2008, Clifford Carnicom on this program. That's remarkable. It's been that long. Whew, time is just ridiculous. Back in just a couple minutes as our fascinating conversation about Morgellons fibers continues. Okay, back with Clifford and learning tons. Go ahead, my friend. This is amazing stuff.
Thanks, Jeff. You know, when that abrupt dissolution of that meeting took place regarding that lab report on the environmental sample, I handed that CEO a letter that I had written for him.
Ah.
And I told that person that if it ever came to pass that this information that was communicated to me about this sample ever became important in this work, and that I knew it was false, and I told him if I ever determined that this was important or relevant to the public's welfare, that I was going to make it known that that report was false. And this is a time, this is being done. I have that report. I never published that report on the net because I knew it was false. And I will not knowingly and deliberately put up false information to confuse or obfuscate the issue. But there was some value out of that lab report, and that was at least mm-hmm. the statement that the sample had
mm-hmm.
a proteinaceous mm-hmm. nature to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I know that report was false is because I was doing my own work. Soon as I got any kind of indication that somebody was saying this was spider webs, this is what they did. They floated it a mm-hmm. couple weeks before the lab report was given to me. As soon as I got any hint of that, I was doing my own work and asking myself, are these spider webs? Sorry, they were not. And are not. And this is where the 3 topics of ridicule that will come up in that last interview, but they are Clifford working with hair perm solution, Clifford finding blood cells in environmental samples, and Clifford digging out dental filaments from his teeth. These are the 3 topics of ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
History is showing there, it looks like there's a reason for those interest level of ridicule on those 3 topics.
Uh-huh.
Because the reason it's important on this hair perm is I was subjecting those EPA, those environmental samples, to mm-hmm. all kinds of chemical tests. It's all in the lab. That's the early stuff, 1999, under the toy microscope. And if you look at all those chemical tests I did, I subjected those things to everything under the sun I could find at that time, all kinds of acids, anything I could get my hands on. And they basically were impervious to anything. And that was one of the things that was unique to them. Except for one thing had a very dramatic and direct effect on it. And what was that? It was hair perm. Oh, and that sounds very humorous, Clifford working with hair perm. But the reason I was working with hair perm was because digging into chemistry books, I was interested in the proteins. And the reason hair perm solution is important, which you can now translate to get away from your funny phrase of hair perms and say alkali solutions, because that's mm-hmm. basically what it is.
There you go.
Alkali solutions are the agent behind this.
Mm-hmm.
They break down the sulfur bonds in keratin. Keratin is the protein that makes up our hair and our skin.
Uh-huh.
And those filaments that I was looking at on this environmental sample showed that they could be broken down, and about the only way that I could get them to break down was with the use of an alkali solution that I was motivated to do because of my interest in clarifying and establishing for myself mm-hmm. the validity of the claim of any proteinaceous nature and the extension of that at a false level to that being of a spider web. But the fact that they were proteinaceous is true. This is true. You can accept their lab report on that if you'd like to, but you can also accept it through a series of chemical tests that will show the reason that solution has an effect on those is most likely due to the breakdown of very strong sulfur bonds that are within keratin, a protein. Remember, keratin being one of the three things that is found in the University of Arizona lab report that we're talking about tonight.
Got it. With the Morgellons fiber sample, for you listeners who just tuned in. There's something else here that just got from Jan. Thank you, Jan. There are such things as photoactivatable fluorescent proteins, PAFPs. Now, these are new tools. The Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University spearheaded their use. They're part of advanced fluorescent proteins, otherwise known as FPs, several of which have been developed by a certain PhD, associate prof, and so on and so forth. This is interesting. PAFPs, photoactivatable fluorescent proteins, and fluorescent proteins, FPs, allow scientists to non-invasively visualize the structures and processes in living cells at the molecular level. It is now possible, for example, to follow cancer cells as they seek out blood vessels and spread throughout the body, or watch cells manage intracellular debris, preventing premature aging and so forth. Anyway, just PAFPs and FPs, it doesn't have to be off-planet, but it's still a spooky issue.
Exactly. Right on target. You know how we talked about photosensitive proteins in
sure.
the retina?
Yep.
We mentioned that tonight, and then we also mentioned the tracking of the fluorescence, that kind of quality, and so there's a case where we're putting both of those things together. Photo sensor, light sensitivity, in combination with an emission of a wavelength to serve as tracking. And by the way, remember that whole thing about medicines being created, okay? We're making things, folks. It's not at the stage of just finding something. We are making things. All that business about new drugs and medicines are made using, you're synthesizing proteins, you're creating things, and hence the obvious interest in the unknown protein, mm-hmm. as well as the two that are there, okay? I have equal interest in all three. It's not just the unknown. There's a role in the keratin here, mm-hmm. And primarily one of structural form. Keratin is very, very strong. Outer shell, almost impervious to anything, a perfect mm-hmm. encasing mm-hmm. a structure.
Mm-hmm.
Interior, albumin, many, many questions raised. Why the heck would I be finding albumin, a serum albumin, a human plasma protein in a filament? So to get back to these six topics, one of the six is the environmental. The other five, I'll just read them, and you'll see the overlap between these, but also the extension of the issue, and they are. Skin samples we can start with, okay? I have a whole class of skin samples that I have that I've looked at over time that, what would we say? You know, as I subjected the EPA sample to the alkali agent and this type of thing,
mm-hmm.
it's something that I have done over the years with the other filaments that I've had. And I see this similar thing, and this is something that's been going on from the beginning. I've never put it in context before, but I have always had this, underlying sense that it looks like we're dealing quite likely with some type of keratin structure encasing these filaments wherever they're coming from. And wherever they're coming from is not just the skin. It is as follows. One of them is the skin. The others are dental samples. They're coming from inside the mouth,
right.
Particularly it seems like the upper cavities. The third would be the urinary system, the urinary tract. These filaments are coming from there. I have more than one sample. Anything that I talked about, I look in the scope. The next one would be saliva. I have these filaments in the saliva. And then we have this obvious connection to the blood. And the blood is not so much at the filament level, but the blood is raising all kinds of questions. You know, we've had one discussion on that.
Right.
There's no end to this blood issue.
Right.
But the reason I'm bringing up the blood is the obvious connection with, let's say, the interest in a serum albumin.
Okay, stand by
on
that.
Along with the work that I've done that has...
Right. Hold on. Be right back. Okay, we're back. And when Clifford talks about filaments, he's talking about fibers, whatever you want to call them. They are indeed filament fibers. We've seen so many pictures of them. The idea of fluorescing proteins is fascinating. The whole thing is fascinating. Clifford, go ahead, and I want to ask one or two questions before the last segment here winds up.
That's great, Jeff. Thanks very much. One of the objectives of tonight's discussion and meeting is for me to declare that I believe that every one of these environmental or physical sample types, and that list is, number one, environmental, number two is dental, number three is skin, meaning fire filaments coming from the skin, this type of thing, number four is urinary samples, number five is saliva samples, and number six are blood samples. Every single one of these should be looked at in detail with sufficient examination and lab work done. Every one of them should be looked at as a minimum. This is not meant to encompass everything, but as a minimum should be looked at from the proteinaceous point of view. And that means in detail with consideration of genetic modification influences or roles that may or may not be associated with these unusual alterations that are appearing across literally from the environment to our body. Another thing to stress is that, you know, this notion that the particular topic of Morgellons, that it is this little skin thing, okay, I keep saying this, and I'm going to keep saying it until it drives home, but this notion of regarding this as being this little rare little thing that affects, a few thousand people across the world.
Right.
And that we can confine this in some little...
tabloid
of some type.
Sure.
It's a joke because the evidence indicates, if you look into it, that these sampling types that I'm speaking of, these biological samples that I'm speaking of, thus far, they are coming from the population at large. Every single individual thus far, I hope to have exceptions. In fact, I expect to at some point. But thus far, every individual that is subjected to this dental procedure is producing this same physical material.
Everyone.
Everyone thus far. And again, we don't extrapolate to say that's a conclusion, but that is the result thus far. And, you know, this notion of something about being in the skin level, it's not the skin, it's the body. And my contention for several years now is that the blood is most likely one of the best indicators we have.
Mm-hmm.
For the existence of these alterations that there is, and that the core of the human being should be being examined, and that our preoccupation at the skin level may be indeed just that, a very limited partial glimpse.
Oh, it's a great misdirection is what it is.
Into the true nature of the extent of what we're speaking with.
Right.
So that's point number one, that we need to look at the population at large at the level that it needs to be looked at, and that is now suggested at the protein level. And the other thing is to finally, folks, whether you like it or not, cross the environmental barrier.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to say that there is nothing that indicates an environmental connection both on the biological side as well as the chemical structure and nature of these samples and the overlap between those and this supposed condition that we're trying to box into a few people. This is what I think is important, and this is what has to be realized, and this is what I'm here to state is whether the Carnicom Institute gets this work done. I don't know. I'm telling you it needs to be done. I'm also saying I'll do my best to help it get done if nobody else will do it.
Right.
But
well,
you cannot have exclusions or limitations on what you're willing to consider. And the environmental part has to be brought in immediately into the picture, and the broad sampling of the population at the core level of the being, eventually down to genetics and DNA, needs to be brought into the picture also.
I totally agree. And we cannot look to the CDC and its bogus Kaiser Permanente Morgellon study to do anything. It's a cover-up. They've been sitting on their alleged results now for the better part of a year. It was supposed to be out last December, if I remember correctly, but we all know what's going on there. This is a real chance now to help support the Carnicom Institute to find out what's really going on, get some real answers. I mean, outside of grant-driven academic platforms, private enterprise issues that the CDC happens to be in bed with, like Kaiser Permanente, we're hamstrung on this issue. And if Clifford's work is any indication of reality at all, and you can take that to the bank that it is and then some, every single person he has tested so far is exhibiting these filaments from a dental sampling procedure that is very simple and is explained on his website. This is suggestive of the CDC talks about a pandemic of swine flu, and they're talking about forced injections, inoculations with a vaccine that will no doubt be ineffective and certainly contaminated and polluted. Clifford talks about environmental factors related to Morgellons and these other fiber issues, which are proteinaceous now, as a matter of fact. You folks cannot dismiss the vaccine issue, the pollution of this planet on 1,000 different levels by countless corporations and countries and companies. We've got a big mess here, huge, and trying to find reality amongst it, all of its many and varied parts, is almost an insurmountable task. But thank goodness for Clifford. Look what he did for all of us in terms of chemtrails. So let's support the Carnicom Institute and help this work move forward. You're not going to get it from your government. We all know that. Anyway, I didn't mean to get off on that, Clifford. Go ahead, please.
No, I really appreciate it, Jeff. And honestly, I want the work done. I don't care how it happens.
Right.
I want the work
sure.
done, and I want the problem addressed. And, you know, if you have your faith in some other place, you go for it. I really don't care. I just want the problem taken care of. You know, humanity deserves a break here, is what it amounts to. We have to get something right for once.
Well, it deserves a break, not a burial, and that's what it's going to get unless we get on top of these things.
And even if there is another... Who knows? Whatever, another private organization. If you have your faith in them, fine, go for it. But I'm saying you cannot set limitations on the subjects or the extent of consideration
Correct.
That you're willing to do. And that
Can't
would be one
with,
of the clues
no.
or keys for you to watch for.
Right.
Is everything's on the table here?
Yeah, no strictures. You got to do real science for humankind, which is exactly what the CDC does not do. All of you know that, or you wouldn't be listening to this program. All right, we have just a couple of minutes, Clifford, so please go ahead and wrap it up any way you'd like.
Yeah, well, I'm sort of done with my rant here, too, if you have any questions. But I've tried to tonight tie in these three areas, and it's been a fascinating process of discovery, particularly on the protein side. It's been there in a latent form for many years. I know at a subconscious level I've had this interest in seeing this common thread. You know, if there's one thing that I can seem to find in this, in these samples, no matter where they come from, it's this proteinaceous quality, and particularly keratin is interesting because keratin appears to be, it's so fascinating to me because, see, keratin is what hair is made out of.
Yes, it is.
Right?
Yeah.
So what a great disguise also. Okay.
Well, excuse me, Clifford, but that ties into many reports of people with Morgellons having hair fibers taken over, having the follicle taken over with something else that sort of looks like hair, but isn't hair, at least in the traditional sense, and these poor people actually can feel the hair follicles moving.
That's right. That's right. Motion is a common symptom under the skin.
I mean, how weird and how creepy is that?
Absolutely right. And what I'm saying is we don't need, you know, you want to play the game of hairs and delusional parasitosis and all this business. You don't have to be dealing with skin fibers. There are half a dozen physical classes of materials that can be looked at that will show certain similarities of form or behavior or
right.
alteration. And do not limit yourself to that. In fact, again, I see it as possibly almost a surface tangent of the core issue. And this blood thing is just this huge issue. You know, we crammed it in at the last, you know, few minutes of the...
We'll do that on our next program.
Let's, of the last session. But, this, yeah. you know, the albumin and blood connection, mm-hmm. you don't go growing blood cells from environmental samples, folks. It's not supposed to happen. And the tests are reliable as I can get them to be. Mm-hmm. I did a great deal of work to satisfy my own standards. Can this possibly be real? Is it positive? I did the best I can, and I got down to the forensic level. You know, the microscope is one thing. It shows us a whole lot when you get up
yeah.
to 5 to 10,000 power.
Oh, yeah.
I have a complete match to the, you know, to the submicron level, the best I can get on all these things we're talking about
wow.
across the board.
Wow.
But in addition to that, you have the determination of the cultured growth of erythrocyte
mm-hmm.
and hemoglobin. Again, hemoglobin is a protein. You have that established at the forensic level now.
Correct.
In addition to
yeah.
the microscopic examination, I have two forensic tests that say this is real.
Well, it's damn real, all right. And this is a huge area of mystery, and a lot of people, again, are suffering. There's so much to say about it. We need to do more on this. The door is always open, my friend, so just let me know when you want to come back on, please.
Jeff, thanks very much. You know, what we have done is at least chartered a path that those that care to can decide whether or not they want to get involved, and I really thank you for that.
That and then some. Thank you, Clifford. I'll talk to you again.
Yeah, have a good evening, Jeff.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Night. The amazing Clifford Kernicum. You hear the passion in that man to do real science, which he does. I hope you can look into supporting him and his work, and at least send him a thank you note. That always helps. All right, quite a program tonight. Be right back with you tomorrow night in 21 hours. See you then.